This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents The Darkness of Evil by Alan Jacobson, narrated by Daniela Accitelli. Chapter 36. Robbie slid into bed beside Vale and touched her foot with his. She jumped. "Oh, my God, that's cold!" "Sorry, I'm freezing. Warm me up." The down comforter had trapped her body heat and banished her own chill 10 minutes ago. Now, toasty warm, she cuddled up to him and wrapped her arms around him. They slept without interruption until a noise startled Vale. She sat up, the cool bedroom air snapping her mind to attention, or the most attention it could muster at 3 a.m. She put a hand on Robbie's shoulder and shook him. "Hey, honey, wake up," he groaned. "Tell me it's not morning." "Yeah, it's morning, 3 in the morning. He rolled over and faced her. "What's wrong?" "I heard something." She reached over to her night table and unholstered her Glock, then threw the covers back and stepped onto the cold wood floor. Robbie swung his legs over the side of the bed and likewise grabbed his handgun. In a low voice, "What did you hear?" "Not sure, but it woke me." "Maybe you were dreaming." And then she heard it again, a thump. She glanced at Robbie. He nodded. They advanced toward the bedroom door. "Where was it?" he whispered. "Good question. Kind of sounded like it was behind the house or..." "In front of it?" Vale nodded. "Which doesn't make sense. How could it be in both places?" They walked down the hallway, lights off, their eyes acclimated to darkness and wanting to keep it that way. The second they turned on a lamp, their night vision would be shot. Another thump. Vale stopped. "Could it be your aunt?" "She sleeps like a rock," Vale said. "Never gets up in the middle of the night." "Still, we want to be absolutely sure before we pull the trigger, you know?" "Yeah, fine." She moved to the front window and peeked through the curtain. "I see a late model pickup halfway down the block, and something behind it looks like an old sedan." "Anything else? You see anyone?" Vale swung her gaze left and right. "No." Again, a thump. "This way. Definitely out back." He led her to the rear door and they took up positions on either side. "Ready?" Robbie tilted his head. "I guess so." Vale pulled on the knob and Robbie pivoted into the yard, where he came face to face with a raccoon creeping out of the crawl space beneath the house. It saw him and got up on its hind legs. "Are you serious?" He stepped toward the animal. "Get out of here! Go on!" It turned and scurried off. "A raccoon ruined our night's sleep?" Robbie yawned. "Apparently. Either I'm sleeping like a log or you're sleeping lightly." "Bismarck's case has me a little jumpy. With him out there somewhere, it's a perpetual feeling of unease. I'm worried about Jasmine." He led Vale back into the bedroom, where they reholstered their weapons. "Look, it was her decision to go it alone without your help." "Only because we failed her. The cop paid with his life, which sucked big time, but I can't fault her. I might have done the same thing." Robbie groaned as he pulled the covers back over his body, shivering from the now cold sheets against his now cold body. "You'll catch him soon." Vale sat up in bed, her mind a tangle of competing thoughts on the case. "Yeah," she said absentmindedly. But it didn't matter because Robbie was already asleep. Chapter 37. Vale spent the morning at the BAU planning the interview that she had requested with the owners of the Lake Ridge home and setting up a secure Skype connection with the Cleveland field office agents. "Knock, knock." She looked up from her desk and found Art Rooney standing there. "Got a minute?"
"I've got 5.
Rooney grinned. "Good. I only need 2. Want to know what I just found out?" Vale lifted her brow. Let me guess. Forensics on that new arson scene. The accelerant? She leaned back in her desk chair. What was it? Kind of interesting. So you know the common ones, petrol, kerosene, mineral turpentine, diesel, complex mixtures of hydrocarbon molecules? Yeah, that much I remember. Well, my guy didn't use any of these, which are all pretty much readily available. For some reason, he used a non-halogenated ether. Ether? Vale drew her chin back. I know. Not something you're familiar with. No, that's not it. I came across it recently, too. Well, it's not rare or anything like that. It's a chemical used in all sorts of things. When I was a kid, they sprayed a variant of it, ethyl chloride, on baseball players who got hit with a pitch to freeze the area and reduce the swelling. No, I mean I saw it in a case of mine. She snapped her fingers. That's what Marks used to subdue his victims. He soaked a cloth with ether and then held it over their mouths and noses. Vale thought a second, then said, Wait, you said your arsonist used it as an accelerant? The kind he used is very volatile, extremely flammable, gives off irritating or toxic fumes or gases. In a fire, when exposed to open flames, sparks, that sort of thing, gas, air, mixtures are explosive. So when combined with what we found there, a sterno flame, it'd work pretty damn well. Unconventional, but effective. Rooney handed her a folder. Copy of the forensics reports for you to read while you're eating breakfast? Can't wait. Unfortunately, we've got laboratory proof of how well that chemical works as an accelerant. It's the same non-halogenated ether used in this unsub's other arsons. That's weird, though, don't you think? That he used an unusual accelerant? It's not unheard of. No, I mean on a basic level. He had reasonable access to common accelerants, but he used an uncommon one. Why would be a key question, but I was referring to the fact that the accelerant used in your arson cases is the anesthetic used in my serial killer cases. Bizarre, don't you think? Not necessarily. Coincidence, if that. Now, if you trace the chemical to a specific manufacturer and batch number in your case that matched the manufacturer and batch number used in my case, yeah, then I'd say it's obviously related. But that's not what we've got here. Vale shrugged. If you say so. Don't take my word for it. Tell me what relevance you think it's got to either of our cases. I'll have to think on it. At first glance, nothing. The arson started after Marks was behind bars, right? So we know he didn't do those. Just the last two fires are suspect. I guess because Marks was in the wild, if Marks is responsible, and if the other fires are truly related to your more recent ones, she thought a moment, unless Marks knows the arsonist. All the arsons are related, Rooney said. Same unsub for all of them. I'd stake my reputation on it, which means none of them are Mark's handiwork. I'll buy that, Vale shoved her hands in her pockets. Hey, we all need to be humbled once in a while, right? You admit that? Of course not. She gathered up her purse and the copy of Rooney's case folder. But it sounded good, didn't it? Vale settled herself into the ergonomic conference room chair in front of a secure laptop. The Skype interface opened. Curtis entered and sat down, a visitor badge clipped to his shirt pocket. You ready? Curtis took a seat. So, we've got the homeowner, Stuart Sheridan? Right, his wife's Nancy, the one with cancer, so we should go easy on him. Unless Stu's a child pornographer. Then we go for the jugular. Vale clicked video call, and the familiar Skype ring filled the external speakers. A suited agent answered the call. Agent Vale? I've got Stuart Sheridan here with us as requested. He pivoted the laptop and revealed a man in his 40s, graying at the temples. Good morning, Mr. Sheridan. Agent Vale, is it? I'd like to know what this is about. I haven't been told anything, but anytime the FBI shows up at your door, it's not good news. No, Mr. Sheridan, it's not. I mean, it's not horrible, but it has serious implications. Let's put it that way. I don't care how you put it, just tell me what's going on. You own the home in Lake Ridge? She read off the address. Yeah, about 10 years now. Why? Can you tell us what you've got in the basement, in the entertainment center? Sheridan cocked his head to the side. How do you know about our basement? What the hell's going on? We had reason to enter your home. It has nothing to do with you, I assure you. That's not an... Mr. Sheridan, this will go a lot faster if you just answer my questions and then I'll explain everything, okay? Sheridan took a deep breath and sat back in his chair. Fine. The entertainment cabinet. You've got DVDs in there? Yeah. Movies my wife and I bought back before Netflix and HBO Go started streaming. And we've got some videotapes of our family trips, stuff like that. Why? Can you describe some of the types of movies you've got there, not the ones of your family? He shrugged. Some romantic comedies? When Harry Met Sally, You've Got Mail, thrillers and suspense, some dramas, Hunt for Red October, No Way Out. We got a little bit of everything. Some foreign films, Chocolat, Edward Scissorhands. Oh, and a bunch of Disney films. The animated classics, the early Pixar ones, Toy Story, Monsters. Really, can you tell me why that's relevant? Any adult films in your collection? Adult? You mean like X-rated? Porn? Like that, yeah. No, he shook his head. My kids play Xbox down there. They watch TV in the basement. It's our playroom. Why would you even ask that question? We found some movies of that nature, and I wanted to know if they're yours. Definitely not mine. Now, Agent Vale, I have to insist you tell me why you've been in my house without our knowledge and how those X-rated movies got there. Vale squared her shoulders. Based on his reaction and body language, she was reasonably certain that Sheridan was telling the truth. You had a squatter living there for the past several months. Sheridan's mouth dropped open. You're not serious. We've been here with my wife. She's in an aggressive cancer treatment program. With the kids and everything, I haven't had a chance to fly home. My neighbor's supposed to be checking on things, taking in any mail that's not forwarded here. He or she isn't doing too good a job. This squatter, what's he been doing in my house? Sheridan shivered, twisted his face with revulsion. This is disgusting. I feel violated. We had reason to question him, and we had an informant tell us where he could be found, your house. There was, well, he had some automatic weapons, and your front door is, it needs to be replaced as soon as possible. It's been snowing here. Our crime scene unit should be finishing up today. Crime scene unit? He covered his face with both hands. Jesus Christ! Mr. Sheridan, did you bring a laptop or tablet with you to Ohio? He looked up. Both? Why? Would you consent to having the FBI do a search of them? What for? We just need to confirm what you told us. Bottom line, if we don't find any child porn, we'll leave you alone. How long will that take? I've got a bid that needs to be completed by this afternoon. Do you have to take it with you? I don't think that'll be necessary. An hour should be sufficient, give or take. But if I need to follow up with something regarding your house, can I call you? He looked at Vale with weary eyes. Of course. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news. I wish you and your wife luck with her treatment. Vail finished up the call, then disconnected Skype and turned to Curtis. I think he was being honest with us.
Yeah, he looked very surprised and genuinely pissed off.
So, Booker Gaines will now have a warrant out for his arrest for possession of child pornography.
I'll see if CSU can get us a list of items found in the house sometime today or tomorrow.
Vail pulled out her phone and looked at the display. Shit! Still nothing from Jasmine.
Problem?
Jasmine's not answering her phone and didn't return my call. Left a voicemail, still haven't heard back.
Try her again. Maybe she didn't hear it ring and doesn't realize she has a message.
When she called last time, it was a number I didn't recognize. Vail dialed it and waited, got a generic computerized greeting, then hung up.
You want to go looking for her? Curtis asked.
Not really. Already got two people we're looking for. I'll put out a bolo.
Curtis rose from his chair. I'll let you handle that. You coming back to the command center?
If you can hang out a few minutes, we can take my car over. Pick up yours later. Chapter 38. As Vail pulled out of the parking lot, she chuckled. Did you see that old Buick? Curtis swiveled his head back to the right.
Missed it. Why?
Mid-60s. I think it was a 64 LeSabre. My friend's mom had one of those. She drove carpool to ballet lessons every Wednesday night.
You? Curtis laughed. Ballet lessons?
What's so funny?
Can't see you wearing a tutu, that's all.
Anyway, she said, those cars, they didn't have seatbelts in the back. Guess it was before it was the law. But when my mom found out, she wouldn't let me go with them unless I rode in the front, where there were seatbelts, which was a problem because my mother had a class on Monday and Wednesday nights, and if I sat in the front, her friend's daughter had to sit in the back without a seatbelt.
Let me guess. That next week, they had rear belts installed.
Yeah, and a couple weeks later, boom, real bad rear-end accident, crushed the trunk, pushed us into the car in front of us, and shot it across the intersection into a telephone pole. That seatbelt saved my life. I would have flown right through the windshield.
Fate, you know?
Don't tell me you believe in that.
Hey, when it's your time, it's your time. Seatbelts, no seatbelts, vest, no vest. Your number's up. You're done in this life.
So why do you have a seatbelt on right now?
Really, Karen?
Because it's the law, and I'm the law. They arrived at the command post, where all team members were present. They spent the next hour reviewing their status on the case. Marks, Kubiak, Gaines, Stuckey, and their efforts to find Marks' last known associate, Scott McFarlane.
While I was in town, Ramos said, I sat down with the inmate Marks got into the fight with at Potter, Patrick O'Shea, wanted to be sure he wasn't in on the escape. You know, like the fight was a ruse designed to get Marks into the medical transport.
It was a ruse, Hurdle said. Only question was whether O'Shea was complicit or just used, even though he got the better of the fight, by design.
And let me guess, Vail said. O'Shea wasn't talking?
Actually, he did. He basically said he had nothing to do with it. Marks insulted him, and he beat him to a pulp.
Vail nodded.
Guess male bravado trumps looking like a stoolie.
This guy's huge, Ramos said. It's like they put Marks on a copier and hit enlarge 10%.
They all laughed.
Point is, no one's going to get in his face, stoolie or not, and that's what made me think he was telling the truth. No way Marks would pick a fight with this guy unless he had other motives.
I think I should mention that I haven't heard from Jasmine.
Should we be concerned? Morrison asked.
Vail shrugged. I am. She's never ignored my calls before.
Try her again, Hurdle said. Over what period of time?
A day, give or take?
We should put out a bolo, see if we can get our army of eyes around town looking for her. Already done. Keep us posted. Something else I wanted to mention, Vale said. Not sure if it's relevant or not, but a weird forensic finding came up in another case I thought I should make you all aware of, just in case it becomes significant or somehow suddenly becomes meaningful to our pursuit of Marks. And that is a series of arsons that have been going on for a while now. First one, a year or two after Mark started doing time in North Carolina. Last two were set after he escaped. And why are we discussing this? Tarkov spread his hands. What's it got to do with Marks? Marks used an anesthetic-soaked rag to subdue his victims. That same chemical was used as the accelerant in the arson cases. Tarkov leaned forward, as if closer proximity would bring greater clarity. The anesthetic is also an accelerant? Hurdle shook his head. I don't see the connection. Hang on a second, Morrison said. What chemical was it? Something unusual as far as accelerants go. I mean, it's a fairly common chemical, a form of ether. Begins with an N, I think. I'm blanking on it. Or an H. Hydrogen or halogen something. She rose from her chair. Let me just get the file. Where are you going? Hurdle asked, checking his watch. It's in my car. I've got a meeting in 20 minutes. We can do it later, Vale said. It's not urgent. Hurdle chewed on his lip. Nah, let's do it now while we've got everyone here. Double time it. Be back in 30 seconds. Vale stepped outside and jogged over to her car, which was two rows away in the Mason District Station parking lot, pulling out the key fob as she approached. She opened the back door, retrieved the file, and chirped the remote. As she turned back toward the command post, her eye caught sight of the 64 Buick parked just ahead of her about 20 yards away. That's the second time I've seen that car. She tucked the folder beneath her arm and advanced on the sedan, which had been backed into a row of spots that fronted a stand of trees. Has the driver been following me? And undercover? For what reason? As she wondered if it was in any way related to the covert work she had done for the Pentagon, something she would not dismiss out of hand, she got a better view of the vehicle and could see that it was vacant. Vale noted the plate and pulled out her phone to ask for a registration check. She peeked in through the window, cupping her face against the glass to cut the glare, when something sharp and hard struck her in the back of the head, slamming her cheek into the doorframe. Vale tried to turn toward her attacker, but he kept her face and body pinned tightly against the car. She tried to grab her Glock, but could not get her hand up to the holster. She writhed and twisted, trying to dislodge the man's grip on her. Come on, Karen, fight! The car keys and file folder hit the ground and her handcuff slipped off her belt as she again tried to wiggle out of his grasp until he grabbed her hair and slammed her face one last time into the car window. Chapter 39. She's not answering. Hurdle lowered the phone from his ear and checked his watch. This is the longest 30 seconds I've ever lived through. Curtis, do me a favor and go see what's keeping her. Otherwise, we'll just do it tonight or tomorrow. On it. Curtis pushed open the command center door and walked down the two steps to the asphalt pavement, then glanced around. Vale was not in sight. He went over to where they parked, circled her car, looked in the back seat, and did not see the folder. So she already got it. He swung his gaze left and right. Then where the hell did she go? He pulled out his cell and called her. It rang three times and he stopped and looked to his right, listened, thought he heard something, but it stopped. The call went to voicemail. He tried her number again, moving in the direction of what he thought sounded like a ringing phone. Straight ahead and a bit to the left, it was very faint, which made sense. Vale kept her volume turned down most of the time. Again, voicemail clicked on. He hit redial and started walking faster. About 10 yards away, he saw Vale's Samsung lying on the ground alongside a set of handcuffs, a manila folder, and a stack of stapled papers riffling in the breeze. He knelt down and looked it over, then swiveled on his heels and checked for blood or other signs of a struggle. But there was nothing. Curtis dialed Hurdle and swung his head in all directions while he waited for the call to connect. Hurdle answered on the third ring.
Look, I've got to get going. Just forget.
You're not going anywhere. Get everyone outside. We got a big fucking problem.
Chapter 40. The team huddled in the area where Curtis found Vale's phone. Curtis's cell was pressed to his ear as he requested that crime scene be immediately dispatched to their location. The only good news was that the forensic technicians were not far off. While there was a local unit in the police department's Mason District Station, they did not handle complex violent crime-related cases. However, they would only need 20 minutes to make the drive from the Massey Building headquarters, adjacent to the records room where Vale and Curtis retrieved the PD-42 regarding the Marks teen shooting.
This is exactly how I found it, Curtis said as he snapped some pictures with his iPhone. That folder there is the one she came out for.
Hurdle put both hands on his hips. So she got it from her car, which is what, about 20-25 yards away? Tarkov, who was walking along the stand of trees, stopped suddenly.
If she had the folder, why wouldn't she just come right back to the RV? She knew you didn't have a lot of time.
She saw something that intrigued her, Hurdle said, or someone called her over and she thought it was important enough to stop.
Maybe somebody in distress?
Or pretending to be in distress?
Curtis turned in place and looked at the large brown, sand and turquoise single-story building behind him.
The police department has cameras. Wait here for crime scene. I'm going to go grab a look.
I'm with you, Hurdle said.
They jogged into the station's lobby and up to the large, bulletproof, glass-enclosed half-moon front desk where two PCAs, or police citizens' assistants, were seated.
Richie's here, Curtis said to Hurdle as they approached. He's a cop on light duty after blowing out his ankle.
Curtis stepped up to the speaker by the pass-through slot.
Yo, Richie. A man in his 30s turned and gave Curtis a nod.
I need the video feed from the parking lot the past hour.
Richie put his coffee mug down and hobbled over to the window.
Parking lot?
Officer was abducted. Move fast, Richie. Her life depends on it. We're coming around.
Jane? Curtis said to the closest PCA. Let us in.
When Curtis and Hurdle entered the horseshoe-shaped administrative space, Richie was clicking his keyboard and downloading the footage to a flash drive.
Pull it up on that screen, Curtis said, gesturing at the one closest to him and Hurdle.
Can I have the mouse?
Richie handed it to Curtis, who began fast-forwarding, watching the seconds cascade by until it got to within 15 minutes of the current time. Then he slowed it down and hit play when he reached the spot he wanted. They watched as Vale, barely visible in the distance, exited the marshal's RV.
Okay, so she's walking toward the camera, Hurdle said.
Toward her car. We parked in the first row of spots.
She disappeared,
Hurdle turned to Richie.
Camera lost her. We have another angle?
I can check.
Don't need it, Curtis said. She's back in the camera's field of view, walking away from her car and the folders under her arm.
They watched Vale's back another few seconds as she headed toward the task force command post, but veered to her right, the spot where they found her phone.
Fuck me, Curtis said under his breath.
What?
What do you see?
Just a sec.
Curtis pulled out his pad and jotted down a note as Hurdle took over the mouse. They watched as Vale bent over to look inside the car window, and a large male figure with a ball cap pulled low on his forehead emerged from the row of trees that stood along the parking lot's perimeter. He struck Vale from behind, her head hit the door, they struggled, and then he slammed her into the car again. She dropped, but the man caught her before she struck the ground. He pulled open the back door and pushed her inside.
Curtis shifted position. This is tough to watch.
He's doing something. Taking her Glock, of course.
And Hurdle tilted his head as he studied the screen.
Looks like he's tying her up.
The assailant got into the front seat and drove out of the lot.
Hold it,
Curtis stabbed at the monitor. Back it up. Hurdle clicked pause and the image froze, rewound frame by frame.
There, he said, pointing at the best view they had of the man's face, behind the glare of the windshield as he started the car. Richie, I need that cleaned up. See if you can get us a decent still image of that asshole's face.
Doubt it. Too far away, but I'll do my best.
And get a screen grab of the license plate, see who it's registered to. Probably stolen, but let me know. A cop's life is on the line. We need everything fast.
I'm on it, Richie said as he picked up a phone on the desk and began dialing.
Curtis removed the USB flash with the downloaded footage and turned to Jane.
Can you tell the Sarge I need a bolo on this car? I think it may be a 64 Buick.
He pulled out his phone and Googled 1964 Buick. Images popped up on his screen.
He scrolled and spread his fingers, enlarging the photo.
Affirm. It's a 64 Buick LeSabre. He read her the license plate.
Got it, Jane said.
That what you were talking about earlier? Hurdle said.
You seem to realize something.
They walked, briskly, back toward the knot of task force members in the lot.
Yeah, that Buick? Vale saw it in the parking lot of the behavioral analysis unit when we left there this morning. Bastard must have followed us here.
Why was she suspicious of it when she saw it?
She wasn't. It was just a car she knew during her childhood. Brought back some memories.
You think it was Mark's?
Hurdle glanced at Curtis.
I keep hoping it wasn't, but I'd bet money that it was.
Chapter 41. Vale opened her eyes. Everything was blurry. She fought to focus and tried to move, but her hands were bound behind her with rope.
What the hell?
She was lying on her right side, facing the back seat of...
Holy shit! I'm in the Buick!
It all now came back to her. She struggled to sit up and saw the back of a head and the unmistakable face in the rearview mirror of Roscoe Lee Marks. He did not glance back at her, did not divert his eyes from the road, which were scrolling left and right, no doubt looking for law enforcement. He had to know that if you kidnap an FBI agent, there would be an alert put out immediately. Then again, there were already alerts issued for his apprehension. Vale leaned forward in the seat to ease the pressure on her wrists.
So, Rocky, what do you have planned for me? Gonna slice lines in my stomach and cut off my genitals?
You think you're so smart, he said. He did not raise his voice. His tone was not one of anger. It was matter of fact. But you're fucking clueless.
Am I? I know all about your murder of Eddie Simmons when you were 14, and I know about your love affair with Booker Gaines.
He swung his right arm around and slugged her in the face, a quick, powerful, fisted backhand that stunned her. It hurt a lot. She saw stars, and she lost consciousness for a brief second. At least she thought it was a brief second. They were still driving, and her head was extended, resting against the back of the seat.
Obviously, that's a sore subject, certainly for me.
She stretched her mouth open to make sure her jaw still worked.
You asked what I had planned for you? I'm going to take you somewhere, and then we're gonna talk.
You're going to tell me what you know about the search for me, what approach your task force is taking, then you're going to tell me where Jasmine's staying. When you've told me what I want to know, well, we'll see.
I'm very angry for what you did to put me behind bars.
Translation, he's going to kill me.
You've got it all wrong.
We're done talking. For now. When we sit down, that's when we'll clear the air.
Vale could not let it come to that. She desperately wanted to hear what he had to say. Her years-long curiosity was screaming at her to press forward, to ask him the question she'd wanted to ask, the one she hoped she would get the opportunity to ask back at Potter.
But that desire to know the answers did not outweigh her wish to live a long life.
She could feel that her Glock was no longer in its holster. No surprise there. It was now probably in Mark's waistband. But Zedek, the dagger-like Tanto she kept sheathed in the small of her back, was still there. And that was not surprising either. Mark's was a career criminal.
but he was not a law enforcement officer trained in the proper ways of frisking an individual for hidden weapons. He likely checked her for an ankle holster. She was not wearing it today, but he had no reason to suspect she had anything other than standard-issue police weapons, a service pistol, and perhaps a smaller backup piece. Vail was not aware of any FBI agents who carried such atypical weapons. Well, other than she and her friend Aaron Uziel. Her bindings were tied tight, but she was able to get her fingers on Zedek's handle. She worked the knife out of its scabbard a quarter inch at a time, keeping her eyes on the rearview mirror, watching Marks to see if he checked on her. He had not, as of yet. Clearly, he did not see her as a threat, so his concern was focused on the more likely immediate danger. Cops, who by now could have a description of the vehicle, and him, and her. He's going to either ditch the Buick soon, or we're close to his secret interrogation site. Hurry up, Karen. Vail cleared leather and had the tanto in hand. Now she had to turn it blade side up and start slicing, but manipulating it into position with her fingertips was more difficult than she thought, and she almost dropped it, which would have been disastrous. She got the tip reoriented and started working on the twisted fibers of the rope. Even not restrained, it would take some effort to cut through this material, but there was no choice. She had to do it. "Do you really intend to kill your daughter?" she asked, hoping to distract him. "I told you we'll talk later, on my terms." "She's your daughter. How can you do that?" For the first time, Marks looked at her in the rear view. She saw intense anger folded into the creases around his eyes and across his brow. "Fine," she said. "I'll drop it." A moment passed. "When we sit down to talk, will you at least answer some of my questions? The ones I wanted to ask you at Potter?" "Yeah," he said, leaning forward and peering down the road. "Why not?" Vail followed his gaze and saw a police cruiser on the right. Marks slowed down. "Don't try anything, Vail, or I may have to slug you again." More fibers gave way. "Once was enough," she said. "Oh, wait. You hit me twice. I lost count. And consciousness." They passed the cop. She watched as he sat in his car, looking at his radar gun, apparently more concerned with catching speeders than apprehending fugitives. "Maybe third time's the charm." Vail flexed her neck left and right. "No thanks." Marks turned onto a secluded side street. No houses in the immediate area and no other vehicles. Shit. Now or never. Vail pressed harder and felt the fibers of one of the loops of the knot give way. "Keep going." A minute later, she felt the rope loosen. "Got it." Her wrists popped apart and she grabbed the knife's handle firmly in her hand, then rotated it to get into position. She whipped it around and slapped it against Mark's carotid, then grabbed a handful of hair protruding from beneath the hat. "Pull the fuck over and keep your hands on the wheel where I can see them." He laughed. "Go ahead. You don't have it in you to slice my neck open." She pressed the blade into his skin and a thin line of blood oozed. "You want to test me? You think you know who I am and what I've done, but you've got no fucking idea." She knocked his hat off and gathered up a full-fisted clump of hair. Yanked back hard, he winced. "No one's gonna question me killing you. No one, because it's justice. Understand, asshole?" He closed his eyes, the only acknowledgement, the only victory he was going to allow her. Vail knew she had to bully him because it was the only language Roscoe Lee Marks understood. Show weakness and he would go for the jugular, literally. "You've got 3 seconds, she said. 2? Marks lifted his foot off the accelerator and the car slowed down. He angled the vehicle toward the right shoulder of the 2-lane roadway and brought it to a stop. "With your left hand, using 2 fingers, remove the Glock and hand it back to me. No fast moves." He did as instructed, and as she released his hair to grab the pistol's handle, keeping the Tanto's pressure constant against his neck, she wanted to check the handgun's chamber, but needed two hands, and there was no way she was going to remove the knife from Mark's neck. "Now, give me the keys." He pulled them out of the ignition and handed them back, but moved them away when she reached for them. She dug the knife further into his skin, drawing more blood. "I swear you fucking try anything, anything, and I'll kill you. Now give them to me." He handed them back and she took them. She wanted to handcuff him, but there was nothing to secure him to. No headrest, nothing except the steering wheel. If she had him lean forward and put his hands behind his back, there would be no way for her to reach over the seat to fasten them. Vale set the Glock on her lap and reached for her cuffs, but they weren't there. She patted the area around her, felt around with her shoes, taking care to keep firm pressure on the Tanto, but they were not there. She felt for her phone. Gone as well. Shit! "Pop your door open, then put your hands on the dashboard. Splay your fingers and push your chest against the wheel." As he leaned forward, she removed the knife from his neck and got out, pointed the Glock at his head as she came around to the front seat. But Marks accelerated hard and the Buick lurched forward, the rear door slamming into her side and spinning her into the asphalt. Vale got to her knees and squeezed off three rounds at the retreating vehicle, pinging the metal and doing nothing to stop Marks as he once again fled into the ether. Vale stood up and watched the Le Sabre disappear down the road. She had forgotten that older cars did not have ignition locks that prevented the removal of the keys unless the engine was off, both an anti-theft and safety measure enacted by the federal government. Son of a bitch. He knew what he was doing. She kicked at a rock in the road and sent it skipping down the pavement. How could I miss that? Because I've taken three blows to the head, probably have a concussion. Vale slipped the Tanto into its sheath, realizing that Zedek had once again saved her life. She had to remember to thank Uzi. The knife was turning out to be one of the best gifts anyone had ever given her. She turned and looked in both directions but saw no one. No houses, no cars, and she had no phone. She could not even look on a map to see where she was. Vale turned and started back from where she came, reasoning that she knew approximately how far it was to get back to the main road. There would be people and cars there and a way to reach someone on the task force. She holstered her Glock and palpitated her swollen face, opened and closed her sore jaw, and felt lucky to be alive. She took a deep breath as she trudged forward, tried to ease her stress, to decompress after all that had occurred in the past hour or so, and then she realized that she had still not heard from Jasmine. Chapter 42. "All right, what have we got?" Hurdle was pacing near the spot where Vale's phone was found, vapor puffing from his mouth like steam from a locomotive. The other task force members stood in a circle nearby, while crime scene technicians processed the area behind them. More snow was expected, so they erected a temporary tent. "Bolo's out," Walter said. "The license plate came back to a used car lot in Fairfax," Curtis said. "I've got a uniform on his way there to talk with someone, see if the Buick was stolen or purchased, and if so, by whom." Ramos held up his phone. "We just got an image of the perp, a frame capture." He played with the screen and threw his head back. "Looks like Marks. Son of a bitch." Hurdle clenched his right fist. "I'm really beginning to hate this guy." "He kidnapped one of our own," Morrison said, "from a goddamn police department, 50 yards from where we were all sitting." "He's got a big set of balls, I'll give him that," Tarkov said, "or a death wish." "Let's look at this a minute," Curtis said, holding up his hands. "Remove the emotion. It's not easy, believe me, I get that. Seeing him take Karen on the surveillance video." His voice caught. "That was tough to watch. But we gotta push that out of our minds. We gotta think clearly." He said it as if he were trying to convince himself. His eyes settled on the photo of Marks on Ramos's phone. "He found out about our task force. He knew about Vale's involvement in the case and somehow figured out where to find her. Assuming that was the Buick Karen saw when we left the BAU, he went to a goddamn FBI office, a 10 most wanted fugitive, and hung out in the profiling unit's parking lot until she left, and then he followed us here. Drove into the police department, parked his car half a football field away from the hounds trying to track him down, and grabbed one of us up. If I didn't want to put a bullet between his eyes, Ramos said, I'd have to call it impressive. Just making us earn our paychecks, Hurdle said. He stopped pacing and turned to face them. We can't let this go unanswered. What have we missed?
Nothing, Tarkov said. Marx is smart. He knows what he's doing. We feed off the dumb ones, catch them doing shit they need to do to stay alive. But Marx, he knows our playbook, how we track fugitives, and he avoids doing that stuff, makes our jobs that much more difficult.
Yeah, well, right now, one of our own is depending on us to work smarter, work harder. Because if we don't... Curtis's phone rang. He glanced at the caller ID, did not recognize the number, and was about to ignore it when something told him to answer.
Curtis!
Hey, it's me.
Karen? Where are you? You okay?
Marx grabbed me from the parking lot and...
That much we figured out. How'd you get away?
I'll tell you when I see you. Right now, all you gotta know is that Marx left me about 20 minutes ago, still driving the tan 64 Buick LeSabre. She gave him the location and requested that someone pick her up.
On my way, and hey, really glad to hear your voice.
Vale laughed.
I could say the same thing.
Chapter 43.
What are you doing here? Hurdle asked, as Vale and Curtis walked through the command post door.
I work here, Vale said. Unless you guys voted me off the task force while I was away on vacation.
Not what I meant, Hurdle said. Shouldn't you be at a hospital?
Vale sat down at one of the workstations. You mean because my head's spinning? I'll be okay. No time to sit in an ER.
You're a mess. Your face looks like hell.
Thanks.
Not what a woman wants to hear, ever. Remember that, Hurdle, and it'll save you years of grief when you get married.
I'm divorced.
See what I mean?
Karen.
I'll get some ice later. It's just swollen.
Hurdle looked at Curtis, who held up a hand. I already tried talking sense to her, boss. Hurdle took a breath and cocked his head. Suit yourself. Ramos and Tarkov are on their way. Just ran something down for me. Be here any minute. You should at least drink some water. Vale shrugged.
Okay. Why?
Stop arguing.
He poured her a glass from the refrigerator spout and handed it to her. Then pulled out several ice cubes and dropped them in a Ziploc baggie.
Put this on your nose. And your jaw. And your eye.
Vale took it and gently pressed it against her skin.
This feels worse.
The door swung open and Ramos, Tarkov, and Morrison entered.
Great. Three of you. Grab a seat. Let's get caught up.
They gave Vale a pat on the back as they passed her chair.
So that Buick, Ramos said, it was sold from a used car lot on Fairfax Boulevard in Fairfax. Owners Oliver Aldrich. Old guy. Pushing 95. Pretty good memory, though. Remember selling the car to a guy matching Mark's description. I showed him the mugshot, and yeah, we got a positive ID.
We already knew that, more or less, Vale said, moving the ice over her swollen jaw.
Right, Ramos said. Paid $120 cash.
Did he seem stressed? Hurdle asked.
Mark's? Not at all.
Took it for a test drive, Tarkov said. If you can believe that.
Marx took the car for a test drive? Curtis shook his head. Jesus, that's one cool dude. Not a worry in the world.
With me, Vale said, he was alert and in control, even when I had the knife against his carotid.
Too bad we didn't hit a bump.
It's like he steps ahead of us.
Hurdle slammed his hand on the table.
Yeah, well... That's our goddamn fault. We're not doing our jobs.
All due respect, Morrison said. He's had time to think this through.
Years to plan it. Bullshit. Bottom line is that he's a felon on the run with limited resources. He's just more resourceful than we are, apparently. Vale fought off a wave of vertigo and got up from her seat. I think I should go lie down.
Finally, some common sense, Hurdle said. Curtis, drive her home.
I can make it, just a little dizzy.
So much for common sense.
I don't want to take any more resources away from the task force. I'll be fine. I'm not that far. I'll drive slow.
As soon as the door swung closed, Hurdle's phone rang. He listened a moment, then said,
"Text me the address."
He hung up and gestured to Curtis.
"You're with me. They got an ID on the guy we found in Great Falls Park. He lived in Falls Church. They went by his house and found his wife and daughter bound and gagged. They're at Fairfax Hospital."
They waited an hour until the emergency room physician, David Pryor, came out to speak with them. Hurdle badged Pryor, and they identified themselves as federal agents on the fugitive task force tracking Roscoe Lee Marks. That got the man's attention. The doctor swung his stethoscope around the back of his neck.
"You think Mrs. Anderson and her daughter know something about Marks?"
"That's why we need to talk with them," Curtis said. "Might be something they can tell us that'll help find him. How are they doing?"
"They came in moderately dehydrated. Another day for the girl and a couple of days for the mother, and you wouldn't have had anyone to interview."
"Are they well enough to talk? We'll keep it short."
Pryor made a mark on the chart.
"You can talk with Mrs. Anderson. Cassie's still undergoing treatment. Maybe tomorrow."
"We'll take what we can get," Hurdle said.
Pryor led them to a curtained-off area and explained to Victoria who the men were.
"Thanks, Doc," Curtis said. "We'll take it from here."
In fact, Curtis and Hurdle had agreed to have Curtis do most of the questioning, since this was his forte and they did not want to overwhelm Victoria.
5 minutes is all you get," Pryor said as he slipped out of the treatment area.
"Mrs. Anderson, I'm Eric Curtis. This is Lewis Hurdle.
Are you the ones looking for my husband?"
Curtis shot a glance at Hurdle. Apparently, no one had done the death notification, but if they told her now, they would likely be unable to question her.
"No, the Fairfax police are in charge of that. Can we ask you some questions about the man who held you hostage, who tied up you and your daughter?"
"He came in through the back door. Nathan wasn't home yet."
"The man who did this to you is Roscoe Lee Marks, the escaped convict from Potter Correctional. We know that much."
"Oh, my God. I heard about that. That was him? A serial killer?"
She shuddered and turned away, looked at the far wall, as if reassessing her contact with him.
"What did Marks want?" Hurdle asked.
Her eyes canted up toward the ceiling.
"Money, jewelry, and our car."
"What kind of car?"
"He took our Mercedes, Nathan's. It's one of the S-Class models."
"Did he hurt you?"
No. He was very threatening, but he didn't hurt us. He made us drink some medicine, Benadryl."
Curtis looked over at Hurdle, who was a foot to his right and slightly behind him, letting Curtis control the conversation.
"Sounds like he was drugging them."
"Makes sense," Hurdle said. "Very smart. I'm getting kind of tired of saying that."
Pryor walked back in.
"Okay, that's good for today."
"Excuse us for a minute," Curtis said to Victoria, then moved to the corner of the room with Hurdle and Pryor.
"How long will you be keeping them?" Hurdle asked.
"Mrs. Turner, another day for observation. Should be able to release her at that time. Cassie, at least one more day, maybe two, depending on how she responds."
Curtis leaned in closer and whispered in the doctor's ear. Her husband was found murdered. She hasn't been notified. I think I should do it now. If you think she can handle it? Pryor sighed. Not ideal, I have to tell you, he said, matching Curtis's volume. Mental state is crucial to recovery. But it's important for her to know, and it's probably best to tell her in the hospital where we can monitor her. Curtis turned around and faced Victoria. To say that this was his least favorite part of the job was an understatement, but he would rather do it with compassion than have some rookie patrol cop dispatched to handle the duties. He walked to her bedside and placed a hand on hers. Victoria, I've got some news on your husband. She read his face, and in that instant, Curtis knew that he did not need to say anything further. Chapter 44. Marks got out of the cab a few blocks from the used car lot. He trudged through the freezing snow, doing his best to keep his balance and avoid slipping on the slick ground. The last thing he needed was to hit his head, lose consciousness, and be taken by ambulance to the hospital. The stupid cops may just get lucky and realize that the guy in the ER was the escaped prisoner they've been looking for. He arrived a few minutes past six. Oliver was approaching with a key in hand, no doubt to lock up for the evening, but Mark stepped inside with seconds to spare, the edge of the door nearly catching Oliver in the nose. Looks like I got here just in time, Mark stuck out his right hand. Buddy, remember me? Yeah, he said, his eyes open wide. I remember you. He returned a weak shake as his gaze traveled Mark's face. He stepped back a few stuttering steps, jawing absent-mindedly, his shoulders tense. Mark knew his secret was out. The buddy cover was not going to work. Had Oliver seen a news report, an FBI bulletin with his photo? Or had Vale or the police connected that old Buick to Oliver's used car lot? He swiveled and took a quick look at the street. No cops. If they had been watching the place, he was sure they would have been on him by now. However the old man found out, it meant he was going to have to get rid of him. He did not want to have to do that, but Oliver left him no choice. Didn't expect to see you again. I know, but the Buick you sold me, well, it had a limited useful life. It was real old, and we both knew it didn't have much time left. Served me well, though, worth every dollar I paid. What can I do for you? Oliver asked, his gaze settling on the phone as he turned and walked toward his desk. Well, I need another car. Uh-huh. He stood behind his ratty chair, holding the back as it rolled a bit left and right with his shaking hands. Well, I'm about to close. I was on my way to lock the door. I usually get out of here by 5:45, but I fell asleep at my desk. How's about you come back tomorrow, 9 a.m.? Marks pursed his lips, as if he was considering Oliver's suggestion. Well, being that I'm here now, and it only takes a few minutes, I sure would appreciate it if we can take care of this right now. I'll give you a few extra bucks. You'll be on your way, and I'll have a set of wheels. Oliver jawed his lips, but did not reply. Mark studied him a moment. So, the cops paid you a visit, huh?